Hello and welcome to Launch. We're broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. I'm joined here with my co-host, Bill McHenry. Bill, how are you today?
Absolutely super, Ron. How about you?
Yeah, if that was any better, I'd have to be twins.
Well, Ron, you know, I want to mention our sponsor today, Patents and More. Patents and More is protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
Thanks. Well, you know, Bill, on Launch, we focus on the launching of a business, you know, both before the launch, during the launch, after, so that all of our listeners can successfully navigate their own launch. And this morning we're featuring David Clark of Malco Design and Deliver Group. Could you introduce David for us?
I sure will, Ron. David is the new business development manager for Malco Design and Deliver Group. It's a service business within Malco Products that produces or provides product design, prototyping, and manufacturing services. Malco Design and Deliver Group, Ron, is based in the Minneapolis area. David earned a BS in marketing and management from Mankato State University and has an MBA from the University of St. Thomas in Venture Strategies. He has over 20 years of experience in sales, marketing, and new product development, and I'm sure we're going to get a lot of cool nuggets from David today.
All right, that sounds great. Well, welcome to the show, David.
Well, great. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I know that in any field, there's always these things called best practices. Could you tell us what best practices are and where do these things come from?
Sure. Well, best practices are, it's kind of the collective knowledge of people that have been doing this for a long time. And after you do it, you know, X number of times, you kind of figure out the best way to do it. And you write that down and you call it a best practice. And if you're a consultant, you go out and make big money with the fancy words. You know, but basically it is. It's just that collection of knowledge of how to do it and how to make things go smoother and better.
You know, and that's something that never really shows up on the balance sheet, but it really adds to the value of a company is that they have some really trained, experienced staff that know what those best practices are.
Exactly. Well, and actually it does show up in the balance sheet because, you know, if you go out and you develop a successful new product, you end up making more money and you grow the business. And if you don't do it right, you end up wasting a lot of time and money and don't go anywhere.
And you're absolutely correct. I was just saying that, you know, it's not a line item on the
on
the financials, but you're right. It does show up.
You know, David, let's start with the first one. What does it really mean to be strategic?
Well, of the 10 best practices that, you know, I put together in the presentation and wanted to talk about today, the first one is being strategic. You know, and a lot of times inventors will go through the process and they'll spend money, they'll do a patent, they'll do a prototype, get a design, try to market the product, and only to find out that their situation is I have a product, now I got to find somebody that I can sell this thing to. And the whole process of being strategic is to start with the market that you want to serve. If you want to be in the craft and wood hobby business, okay, start looking at customers in that category and look at a job that they're doing very frequently and find a way to make that job easier by minimizing tasks, eliminating tasks, making it safer, whatever. Because by doing that, you're starting with, here's the customers I want to go to, you know, and you know how many of them there are, and you know what kind of needs that they have. That way, before you start the invention process, you have a target market waiting for you at the end of the process. You don't get done and develop your product and then keep your fingers crossed that you're actually going to sell it. So being strategic means that you start with your end goal in mind.
That's interesting. Well, you know, David, there's a lot of design firms in the marketplace. When an inventor is starting out and doing their research on design firms, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, you know, obviously an internet search, you know, talk to people that, you know, the United Inventors Association is a good resource for people. You know, another hidden gem is the Minnesota Inventors Congress that does some fabulous work in, you know, educating and making people knowledgeable. But when you're talking with a product design firm, or in fact, even a patent attorney or any other provider that you might engage, you know, one, the first thing is chemistry. Do you like the person? Do you trust them? Are they able to explain to you things in a way that is clear and concise and you understand it? If you ask them a question, do they get mad at you or do they try to bull rush it? Just say, look, don't worry about it, just sign it and let's go. So you want to make sure that you're going to establish a good working relationship with the people, because you're buying from people, and you want to make sure that you have a relationship with the people. The second thing you want to do is take a look at the different competencies or the markets that the firm has worked in. For example, if you're trying to design a hand tool, okay, which is an area that we're really good at, you really don't want to go to an electrical engineering firm because they haven't really done anything in that area, and it's probably not going to be a good fit for them. So you want to look for companies that have done things that are at least similar or the same skill sets as to what you're going to need when you get moving forward. That makes sense?
Yeah, it really does. Sure. Yeah, I know a lot of inventors, you know, when they're more shopping, whether it's design firms or patent attorneys or whatever, a lot of them will just say, you know, how much do you charge? Okay, because they think it's, you know, apples versus apples. And it reminds me of the famous quote from John Glenn as he was getting ready to lift off on his first flight. He's looking around at everything and says, and all of this was built by the lowest bidder.
Exactly.
And well, so price is not the only thing.
And the one thing that I would encourage people to do is to, you know, when I was out looking for a firm to help me do my website, for example, I would literally talk with a vendor, and he would write on a napkin, okay, $6,000 to develop a website with four pages, and that's all I would get with the quote. And it's like, okay, so how many pages are you going to develop on that website? Who's going to do the graphic work? Who's going to do the writing? Where are you going to get the pictures? Who's going to do the search engine optimization? Who's going to do the coding? So if you're going to enter into agreement with a service provider, you need to spell out those details. You need to understand what the service provider is going to be responsible for and what you're going to be responsible for. And if you get somebody that just wants a lump sum figure, you know, and isn't going to give you the detail underneath, you know, that should be a red flag to use a lot of caution moving forward.
Well, you know, I find that, David, in my businesses, too, and talking to people, and so many people don't research the people they're working with.
Yeah.
And it's really not that difficult to do, as you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, today there's this new service out there called the Internet, and you can find a lot of information pretty quickly on somebody to find out what they've done. Ask people for references. You know, I mean, if you can't come up with three good references, boy, you got bigger issues.
You know, one of the things that I always recommend people do is, you know, really do an RFP, a request for quote or a request for price. And when you go about doing that, tell our listeners how you go about writing one. Maybe that'll help our listeners in understanding what they should really be looking for.
Well, if you're going to write a request for proposal, what you want to do is basically spell out that this is the scope of work. I am looking for a firm that can design a product. You don't have to tell them in exact detail because you want to protect your confidentiality. You know, you want to protect your patent status. But at a high level, tell them, is it an airplane? Is it a refrigerator? Is it a basketball? But I'm looking for somebody to develop this kind of a product category, and I want, you know, I need CAD models made. I need a prototype made, you know, and help me find a supplier. Or just tell me exactly what it is that you're looking for. You know, and actually, you know, one of the things that I encourage people to do is before you go out and start contacting potential vendors to supply something for it, make sure you've done some of your basic homework first. You know, I can't tell you, there's probably four or five prospective clients that have called us and said, hey, Dave, can you develop a prototype for me? And we do what we call an exploratory meeting where, you know, we get a non-disclosure agreement in place, and then we do a web meeting so that we can be in real time looking, you know, at the pictures of their idea, their drawings, and kind of talk about what it is they're trying to do, what they're trying to accomplish. And while we're on the web meeting, we can go out to the Internet, and you look out on Amazon.com, it's like, oh, you mean like this product right here? You know, and there's people that are already out there selling the exact product or something similar. It's like you really need to catch that low-hanging fruit before you spend the time trying to find a provider, or, you know, basically waste the provider's time, because when you come with a provider, you also want to make sure you make a good impression on them, because, you know, Bill, I know that in your business, you know, that if you, when you interview a potential client, the provider is also looking to say, is this client going to be a good fit with our business?
That's right. That's right.
Nobody wants a problem customer. So is that inventor trying to find a service firm to help you? You know, if you can be organized and have your ducks in a row, it will make a good impression on that provider and make them want to help you all the more.
You know, David, comment on what you think of people. They just a lot of entrepreneurs and inventors will choose by price. Comment about that.
Well, you know, there's an old adage. You know, when I was a young man learning the sales trade, it was by a guy by the name of Zig Ziglar, and he said, you know, he told the story of this that sometimes it's better to pay more than what you expected and get what you really want rather than find out that you didn't pay enough. Because in the first case, you may be out a few more dollars, but you get what you want. In the second case, if you go cheap, you'll have spent those dollars but not get what you want, and you end up wasting that money. So it's really not a matter of just finding the low-price provider. It's a matter of finding, and even in government, what they do is they define it as the lowest qualified bidder. It can't be just some guy off the street with a low price. You want to make sure that if they're giving you a low price, that they're capable of giving you what you want and that you're getting the things that you truly need.
And that's a real good phrase, lowest qualified buyer. Now, you mentioned doing basic research and going to Amazon. I know that I got a call not too long ago from an inventor here in Atlanta. She's called up and says, I need you to do some patent work for me. I'm like, well, time out. You know, what are we talking about? She says, well, it's an electric car jack. You know, you plug it into the cigarette lighter and you put it underneath the car and you push a button and it lifts up the car so you can change the tire and, you know, not really get dirty and sweaty and everything. I said, well, you know, I've never looked at that area, but my intuition tells me that's already been done. I said, go to google.com/patents, enter in the word electric car jack, and call me back and tell me what you find. 5 minutes later, she calls back and says, you're right, it's been done. Thank you very much.
I have people do the exact same thing with me. And what people will ask me, Dave, what should I do first? Should I do a patent application first or work with a design firm first? And what I tell them is the answer is both. The first thing that you want to do as an inventor is exactly like you said. Go out to Amazon, go out to any of these internet shopping sites, go out to Alibaba. Alibaba is a global sourcing internet site. But go out, is there anybody already making something very similar to what you're doing? If there's a lot of people doing something similar, that's probably a good clue that getting intellectual property might be more difficult. In fact, I had one lady call me, and just a wonderful lady, very, very smart, and she says, hey, can you make this product for me? I said, sure, I think we can do that. Do you have any pictures of it? Well, she pulled up this website, and it was this company in China making a product that was 90% of what she wanted, but she wanted some small changes to it. I said, look, you're at a stage where, you know, you want to test market this thing. Don't spend $5,000 or $10,000 with me inventing the wheel. Call this company in China, get a dozen samples, and use that as your prototype. You know, there's nothing wrong with the school of hard knocks. The key is to keep the tuition low.
Yeah, the way
I've
heard.
And like you said, don't hire a patent attorney to go out and do a patent search if it's something you can find on the internet in 10 minutes. You know, I mean, so I tell them, you know, go out, do that do-it-yourself patent search, do the Amazon search. And if what you come up with, you can't find it, great. Then go to a patent attorney and say, hey, I need a professional search done, because the patent attorneys like yourself, these are the guys that know the tricks of the trade. They know the different cross-referencing, et cetera. They know how to do it. But you don't want to pay an attorney to find something that you could do in 10 minutes. So once you do the patent search and then you say, okay, here's the landscape. You know, there's a patent here, and a patent here. Anything outside of that is clean, then talk with a design firm like us or somebody else and say, okay, here's what I want to do. Let's design it. Because I've had people come to me and says, Dave, I just got my patent. I want you to build a prototype for me. And I am now locked into that patent, all the drawings in the patent. I can't deviate from it. So if there's a manufacturability issue, which means, you know, it's going to cost you more to make or you can't make it, I can't fix that problem for the client because they've already spent the money on the patent. Or to fix it, they have to tear up the patent and start all over. So engage the design firm, figure out your basic general design, and once you've got that figured out and you know your patent landscape, then engage the patent attorney to move forward with the patent process.
Yeah, the entrepreneur and inventor really has to really have some good checkpoints to really follow, don't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and the key is don't spend money that you don't need to.
Sure. The critical failure points are a lot of things that entrepreneurs and inventors have to think about too, Dave. David, what can you give us some techniques that maybe our audience could use to identify some of these failure points? And maybe explain what a failure point is too.
Yeah, that's where I was going to start out. You know, for a critical failure point is something about the product or the idea that is just going to kill it. You know, for example, you know, there was a college student in England that came up with an idea for a low-cost bicycle, and he made the frame of the bicycle out of cardboard. Not only was it low-cost, it was low-weight, plus it's recyclable. A critical failure point that you have to figure out is what happens if it rains? What's going to happen to that cardboard? So before you go into the process of putting together a CAD model for the bicycle or figuring out or building a prototype and trying to ride it around, figure out if the cardboard is actually going to survive, you know, the inclement weather or how you're normally going to do it, because that's kind of the weak link in the chain. So when you're looking at techniques to identify, you know, a critical failure point, you know, look for things that are part of your solution, like what part of this is a known solution and what is an unknown solution. For example, if I need to bolt two pieces of metal together, okay, well, a bolt is a known solution. Okay, but if you're trying to do the same thing with a piece of plastic, well, that's kind of an unknown solution, and you want to make sure that piece of plastic will hold the pieces of metal together the way that you need it to. You know, so if you're trying to develop a new technology, that, you know, that's kind of a big red flag. You know, or if you're using a new material, you know, for example, if you're trying to use plastic instead of metal, you want to make sure that the plastic is going to hold up in the circumstances where you're trying to replace a metal part. Or if you're using a new technique for making something, that, you know, that you want to make sure that's a critical failure point. That's something to look for. Or if you're doing a combination, if you're doing a new plastic part with a different manufacturing process, okay, let's find out if you combine the two products together. For example, you might have a known product, vinegar, and a known product, baking soda. Okay, not a lot of risk there. But when you combine the two, they don't react well together. So if you're combining something, you want to make sure that they're going to react, they're not going to have a negative reaction, if you will. You know, and when you're looking at it, you know, there's also some external considerations for the idea. For example, safety. You know, is there a safety reason why you would not want to do this product? You know, or an environmental reason. You know, I was going to make this product out of lead, but well, if you're selling a child's toy, making that out of lead is a critical failure point. You want to find a different material rather than make it out of lead. Or regulatory. You know, if you want to develop a wireless transmitter for a garage door, for example, you know, if the FCC is in the process of rewriting their regulations on, you know, the electromagnetic waves, the radio emissions, if the FCC is in the process of changing the regulations, you want to make sure that your product is going to meet the new regulations. If that makes sense to you.
Sure.
You know, or for example, we have a client that makes a dust containment product, and the EPA came out with new regulations about particulate control, and their product is selling off the charts now because, you know, they've got the only product on the market that's going to meet that dust containment. Well, if you were one of the people that don't meet that product, that requirement, when the new regulation came in, you're dead in the water. And that's a critical failure point. Does that make sense to you?
Sure does. And, you know, David, you know, you're talking about the cardboard bicycle, and it reminded me of when I was taking a class on how to pass the patent bar. They gave an example of the problem that was presented is that a lot of times shopping carts, you know, end up leaving the area and end up in a deserted piece of territory and rusting away and just being a real eyesore. So the inventor said, well, you know, the solution to that is to come up with a biodegradable shopping cart. And while there were some hurdles patent-wise of biodegradable and shopping cart, they were able to get over those hurdles kind of with some intriguing arguments. But so it ended up being patentable. But, you know, that's not marketable because, you know, shopping carts, you know, in front of a grocery store sometimes are out in the rain. And the store owner is not going to want to see all of his shopping carts kind of dissolve away when a big thunderstorm comes up.
You're exactly right because, you know, I was at the INPEX invention show a couple of years ago. You know, and everything that was displayed there is public domain, so I'm really not revealing anything confidential. And if the guy's listening to me, I apologize, but I want to comment on it. That there was a gentleman there that had developed if you can envision a 2-liter soda bottle, and he developed a plastic piece that the soda bottle slid into, and this plastic piece then became a handle so that it was easier to pour the soda out of the 2-liter bottle. Again, it's an idea that was patentable, but it had a fatal flaw. And the fatal flaw is, one, if you're not able to grab, you know, a 2-liter bottle and pour it, well, what's your alternative? Well, it's not buying his handle. You buy a liter bottle or a 12-ounce bottle or a can. So your competition isn't necessarily just because you can get a patent doesn't mean it's there. Your competition is not only products that are already sold in the market, but it's customer inertia. So if the customers don't have your product today, how are they solving the problem you're trying to solve? You know, in the case of this guy with the bottle holder, now you got an extra piece of plastic. What are you going to do with the thing when you're not using it? It becomes one of those things that you throw in a drawer, becomes cluttered, and either ends up on a garage sale or in the recycle bin. You know, and if it's not something that truly adds value and is better than the do-nothing scenario, you're really not going to be marketable either.
Yeah, that's very true. When you're documenting these assumptions, David, what would you recommend an inventor or an entrepreneur do?
Well, you know, every project that when you're developing a new project, you have assumptions on it that you're making an assumption about how big the market for this product is. You're making an assumption of how much the customer is going to pay for it. You're making an assumption on where you're going to have it made, how much money you're going to make. Every plan is an assumption. And it's an important thing that you understand, you know, one, that you have assumptions, but number two, also understand where the assumption comes from. You know, and I tell the story of an executive who said, our product needs to be red. It's like, okay, great, and they went out all of a sudden you have this assumption that the product has to be red. And if you question why did it have to be red? Well, it turns out that red was the wife's favorite color. And when you go out to the marketplace, colors on products often have meaning. For example, in a hand snip, an aviation snip, a red snip, red handled snip means it cuts to the right. Yellow handle means it's a combination of both, and a green means it cuts to the left. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to market with a red grip, you may be communicating something to the market that's not correct, or it's a color that just doesn't look good in that product category. So, if they had not challenged the assumption, why do we want this thing to be red, they might have gone to market and had a problem with the product at introduction. So by writing down the assumption, you could challenge it and understand where it came from. You may decide that, hey, you know what, going with red is just fine. But you may decide that, you know what, I don't know the outcome of this. We should maybe do a little bit more research before we pull the trigger on it. You know, the whole goal, you know, of best practices is to identify problems before you spend the money on it. So the earlier in the process you can identify a problem, the less expensive it's going to be to fix.
And that brings us, you know, to customer feedback. You know, how can an inventor involve potential customers yet maintain the confidentiality that they need?
Well, and again, every case is going to be unique. You know, I mean, if you are, you know, obviously I encourage people, talk with your patent attorney, you know, and make sure, I'm not an attorney, but make sure that you've taken steps to protect your idea, that you have it documented. You can talk to people and have them sign a non-disclosure or a non-compete agreement before you show them the idea. You can also talk to them about the solution in high-level terms. For example, the guy with the product for pouring the Coke bottle. You know, okay, so you can ask your friends, you know, hey, do you ever run into trouble trying to hold on to a 2-liter soda bottle when you're pouring it? Really, how often does that happen? And when you do that, what is your solution to that? You know, how do you solve that problem now? And, oh, now if I had a product that made it easier for you to hold on to that, so that you could pour that bottle with one hand and be easier to hold on to, is that something that you would be interested in? And how much would you pay for something like that? So you can ask questions in very general terms about the problem you're trying to solve without disclosing the specifics of how you plan to solve it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, David, you mentioned the 10 best practices that we've been talking about. Which of the 10 is maybe the one that's most violated by someone that's an innovator?
Well, obviously, I think the answer to that is market research. Well, let me back up.
Okay.
For the members of our audience that aren't familiar with the 10 best practices, number one is be strategic. Number two is do the work to understand your customers and your markets. Number three is to commit your customer requirements to writing. Number four is to create project checkpoints. Number five is to plan your work. Number six is to identify and resolve critical failure points early in the process. Number seven is to involve potential customers as early as possible. Number eight is to document your and challenge your assumptions. Number nine is to manage expectations. Number 10 is to seek flexibility. So out of those 10, the one that I see violated the most often is number 2, is doing the work to understand your customers and your markets. That, you know, and a lot of companies will go to market, and they get an idea, and they say, okay, this is a really cool idea, let's go out and develop it. But they don't ask their customers how they currently use competitive products or the do-nothing scenario, or how much they're willing to pay, or what kind of features they want, and they just kind of rush in and develop the product, and then try to sell the product later on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if you're going to design a product, the most important thing that you need to figure out before you embark on anything in the invention process, you need to know how many units you're going to sell. And the second most important thing is at what price you're going to be able to sell that. If you answer those two questions, those are the most important things you need to know. Because, one, your unit volume is going to dictate your design. Because if you're going to sell 1 million pieces a year, that's great. You need to design the product so that it will run on equipment capable of keeping up with 1 million parts a year. Recognize you're going to pay a lot more for tooling to do it, but because you have so much volume, the tooling cost per unit's a lot lower. Now, if you're doing a product that you may only sell a couple hundred of a year, you don't want to invest in that big expensive tooling because, one, you'll never recoup the tooling cost, and two, your minimum order requirements from the factory will swamp you. You know, you don't want to buy 10 years of inventory right out of the gate,
right?
You know, to do that. So something that's going to be run on high-volume equipment versus low-volume equipment, you're going to design the product very differently. So you want to make so, and that's an important consideration. The other side to that is when you're doing your business planning, you look at how many units am I going to sell, and this is what people will pay for it. And then you can plan, this is going to be my gross margin, how many profit dollars I'm going to make per unit. And you take the number of units times the number of profit dollars, and that's how much money you can afford to spend to develop your idea and still have a profitable venture.
Gosh, you know, it's so true. A lot of people I talk to in my business, they'll talk about money they're making, but they're just talking about the actual revenue, not the actual profit.
Exactly.
We'll really confuse it.
Yep.
Well, you know, David,
and there is a big difference between revenue and profit.
Yeah. A lot. David, you know, there's professional product developers at one end of the scale, and then there's what we call Yahoo inventors on the other end of the scale. And usually the Yahoo inventor will say, you know, everybody's going to want one of these, and price is no object.
Okay.
But, you know, I don't think everybody wants anything that I know of, because I once did research on the VCR. There were actually some people that never, ever bought a VCR. They had something like, you know, 98%, you know, penetration, but there were some folks, even when the VCRs went down to $9.99, you know, when the DVD players came out and everything, they still didn't buy one. Yeah, so nobody, there's nothing that everybody's going to want one.
That's exactly true. And, you know, and to say everybody's going to want one, well, I tell you what, I spent, you know, I've been with Malco Products for 10 years now. In 7 of those years, I spent as the guy at Malco that screened new product ideas. So I was, you know, responsible for developing new products. So I went to the market and I looked for new products myself, did the research, but I also fielded the phone calls and emails from inventors that wanted to share their product idea with Malco and have Malco develop and market the idea for them. And what you said is absolutely right. I've got this product. It is fantastic. Everybody's going to want one, and it doesn't matter the price. And those people, basically, I dismiss because they have no clue what they're doing.
Yeah, it's cool.
And I don't mean that to be mean. It's just that, I don't want to, in that role, I could not afford to waste my time on somebody that had not done at least a minimal amount of homework.
Yeah, because, every warning bell should have gone off on your head when you hear that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, David, in those 10 years, do you have any products that are kind of a poster child for Malco Design that you're really proud of?
Well, the one product that I'm most proud of with Malco Products that I was involved in the development of is a product called the Turbo Shear, T-U-R-B-O space shear, S-H-E-A-R. And basically, it was an attachment for a cordless drill that you chucked it up like a drill bit, and it allows the user to cut sheet metal as though you had a power shear without the cost of a power shear. So you could chuck it up, cut metal, unchuck it, and go back to drilling holes or driving screws. And it was a tremendous success for the company. That's a product that I'm very excited about.
Yeah, that's super.
Yeah, David, tell us a little bit about Malco Design.
Okay, well, the Malco Design and Deliver Group, we're part of Malco Products, which is a 60-year-old manufacturer. And about 3 years ago, our board of directors decided to create a service business that would complement the product business. And we chose product design and engineering, one, because it's something that we know a lot about and have a very good track record of doing it. But number two, we had also dealt with some design firms in our own business with not very good success. So we felt that we could offer this service with a very pragmatic approach. And what I mean by that is a lot of the design firms that we dealt with at Malco focused on glitz and glamour. Very, very beautiful, sexy looking designs. I mean, the kind of thing that you'd want to submit to an industry award panel. In reality, you can have the most beautiful design in the world, but if you can't afford to make it, or you can't make it in the volumes, or at the cost, or at the quality you need, what is the point? So when we created this business, we wanted to focus on being pragmatic, of taking the idea, finding the most cost-effective way to meet what the customer wanted it to do, give you a good quality design, but have something at the end of the process that was manufacturable. And not only is it manufacturable, but we wanted to take it a step further rather than say, okay, here's the CD with all your drawings and specifications on it. We wanted to be able to bridge the gap from getting the product designed to getting it manufactured. And so that's part of our name. The design means we do the front end, the product development, the design, the engineering, the prototyping. But deliver means that we also will help our clients basically get set up with manufacturing so that they can produce and sell the product.
Okay. Well, David, this has been great. How can our listeners get in, learn more about Malco Design and get in touch with you?
Well, absolutely. We have a website called Malco, M-A-L-C-O, D as in dog, and then the number 2, and then the word group, MalcoD2Group.com. And if you go down, if you go out to our website, we have an invention portal. If you go down to the bottom of our website, there's a light bulb, and you click on the light bulb, and it takes you to our inventors portal. Or they can just give me a call at 866-204-0148. We're pretty easy to reach.
Okay, that's super. Well, thanks for being on the show today, David. Our listeners really appreciate you sharing your experiences and insights in the world of design.
Absolutely. I'm glad to do it. You guys put together a good program here. I've been very impressed with everything I've seen and the other shows I've listened to, and you guys certainly put together information that people can trust.
Thank you very much. Another great show, Bill.
Gosh, it sure was, Ron. It was really super. And I want to give a special thanks today for our sponsor, Patents and More, your trusted guide to the innovation jungle.
And go to our blog at http://thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com to listen again to today's show plus the previous shows. This is Ron Reardon and Bill McHenry signing off another great session of The Launch Hour.